Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. Scholars and pastors regularly point to specialized, quote-unquote, technical language in Paul's epistles to make the case that Paul was intentionally subverting Roman power by applying to Jesus terms that the ancients commonly applied to the Caesars. My guest today has done the hard work of analyzing the inscriptions, coins, and material remains of several key ancient cities to see how they talked about the Roman emperors in the New Testament period. In our conversation, he shares his own journey to become an independent scholar, as well as how his research offers a corrective to what many are saying about imperial divine honors. Here now is episode 555, Was Paul Really Subverting Caesar? With Dr. D. Clint Burnett. Dr. Clint Burnett is my guest today on Restitutio. Welcome, everyone. He's an independent scholar with research interests in early Christianity and Greco-Roman material culture. He holds a PhD in biblical studies from Boston College. He's a priest in the Anglican Church in North America and a full-time financial advisor specializing in helping clergy. Do I have that right? Welcome to the show, Dr. Burnett.
Please call me Clint, and you got everything perfect.
Okay. So today we're talking about your book, Paul and Imperial Divine Honors, published by Eerdmans. But first, I'm curious about you. For us low church folks, what is involved in you serving as an Anglican priest? And while you're at it, how is it possible to also work a full-time job as a financial advisor too? Maybe sure. Just let us into your world a little bit.
Yeah. So what it's like to serve as an Anglican priest is always on call, always for the rest of my life. So priesthood is for until I enter into the church triumphant. Basically, what I'm there to do is to be a pastor. And then when need be, I'm sort of part-time priest. My parish is blessed with two really good priests. I serve every Sunday doing something, but I'm rarely, only one or two Sundays a year or 1 or 2 weeks a year am I the priest on call, meaning that, you know, if you need anything, you can call me because the two other priests are out on vacation. That's typically when people need them. So it's usually a busy week for me. So that's my life as a priest. Any questions about that?
So it's not a 40-hour a week job.
Yeah, correct. So I'm blessed to be part of a parish who allows me to be part-time and knows that I'm part-time. You know, I talk to other, because I serve a lot of clergy, I talk to a lot of pastors in East Tennessee, and they're like, hey, I'm part-time. But really, they have two full-time jobs. I'm blessed to be part-time. So, you know, I basically preach once a quarter. I'm in charge of youth catechesis at my parish. Oversee second grade through up, mainly focus on 9th through 12th grade. And then lead a theology on tap group with a deacon, just a men's group where we get together, drink beer, and talk about either the Bible, something in the tradition of the church, or something distinctively Anglican, which is a great time. So I only do that once a month, and I don't lead every one of those. And then I try to do one or two, well, at least one pastoral visit a week. I can do, you know, more pastoral visits if I need to, but also as part of taking vows of priesthood, I'm committed to prayer, scripture reading, praying for parishioners and those types of things. So I guess there's things that I do throughout the day that I do as a priest. Everything I do as a priest. I believe there's an ontological change that's taking place. But, you know, there are some things that I do more than others, and I'm able to work a full-time job and still be a part-time priest.
And why financial advisor?
Yeah, great question. So in 2020, I decided that we wanted to stay. So we had moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, where I could do a interim position and teach part-time adjunct at a school here in Knoxville. After we got here, I was in another Christian denomination, actually, but I was going to Anglican Church in Boston before I graduated with my PhD, and we got down here and decided we wanted to be Anglican, and then my previous denomination didn't really practice ordination, but I wasn't ordained, so I couldn't really do anything, so I had to find a job, and there's not much one can do with a PhD in the New Testament, believe it or not, so I applied to like 50 jobs and I had one place that contacted me back and they're like, oh, well, you can start selling just life insurance. And then from there, I quickly passed all of my licenses and securities exams and became a financial advisor. So it was basically by luck. It was a God thing, you know, because everybody else said no. I mean, I even got said no by like UPS. They did not even want me. So it was the
Sorry,
only place
I
that.
don't mean to laugh at you. It's just
No, no,
you
no.
know, I've read your book and it's just
Yeah.
ridiculously scholarly, and you know, whoever wrote this book is obviously a very important person. And just the thought of UPS turning their nose up at you. That's
Yeah.
really funny.
It's comical now. And so the only place, financial advisor by accident after I started, my boss said basically I can start my own practice and own firm. He said, just figure out some people group that you want to help. And I'd always had a heart for pastors and clergy. I wanted to teach in seminary. And so I said, why don't I just, work with pastors and clergy? So now I spend my days. Basically, 4 days a week, I take off on Fridays. That's when I usually do visiting for church as a priest. But I spend, most of my days just helping pastors kind of navigate their taxes, number one, because most people don't know how they're taxed. Housing allowance, what is that? How's it taxed? All those types of things. Helping them set up their retirement accounts and then trying to help them maximize their investments and also minimize taxes, make sure they're covered with life insurance and are making good, sound financial decisions. Because pastors notoriously don't. So yeah.
Yes, that's true. I don't want to put you too much on the spot, but
No, you're fine.
what was the decision to not pursue working in a university as a professor? What went into that?
So it was s several things. We decided that we wanted a family, and I just did not want to, I could have gotten a job, but it would have been a temporary position. I didn't want to. And I have friends and colleagues who are zigzagging all over the world, doing a couple years here and a couple years there. It just got to the point where it's so political now trying to find a job. Just the facts, whether wherever you're at on the political spectrum, trying to get a job as a professor right now is so political. And so it was the fact that I would see people applying for the same jobs, people whom I knew well applying for the same jobs. And I knew their CV and I knew my CV, and they would get jobs and I wouldn't. And I said, well, I mean, that's not fair. I mean, it's not. This should be a merit-based system, in my opinion. We should want the best people instructing seminarians, future scholars, those types of things. But the political climate is what it is. And then 2020 happened and George Floyd happened. And I just realized that, to be honest with you, there's no way for me as a white male to find a job. That's the truth. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. So I said, well, what can I do now? And that's when I started applying for jobs. And that's when I eventually became a financial advisor. But two, it's just, I also saw, I mean, to get really personal, which I'm, happy to do because my life is an open book as a priest. I saw really people I loved and respected get dragged through the mud with false accusations of rape or sexual abuse. Their school would put them on leave. They would do a complete investigation. They would come back totally innocent, and still people did not want them to be there. So I said, why do I want to put myself in a position where my life can be ripped apart by one person taking a dislike to me and accusing me of doing something? So it was a combination of all of those things, and just said, man, I'm happy doing the things that I do now. And the third thing would be to be honest, on the political side of it too, is I've pulled out of a few writing projects or a project just because I feel like you should use the best scholars in the field. And I don't care who those scholars are, but to be told that I have to use certain people because of their gender or the color of their skin, I want to use those people. But at the same time, if you're teaching an undergraduate course, the goal, in my opinion, and this is probably controversial, probably gonna get raked over the coals for this, but is we want the
Well,
best.
that's the benefit of the freedom you have, is that you can speak
Right.
your
Yeah.
mind, right?
Yeah. We want people to be able to have the best education possible. And for me, that's reading the giants. And it's not this particular person because they do this niche thing or So, you know, all of that, just, you know, being forced to do some of those things where it's no longer about doing solid scholarship. It's about basically being an advocate for things. And I just don't think historians, I think we should be advocates by the good history that we do, not sacrifice the historical critical method to things that take us away from learning more about ancient Christianity. So it was a combination of those things. I decided, you know what? I want to be able to be a free agent, say what I want to say, do exactly what I want to do. No one's going to fire me. No one's going to accuse me of sexual assault. I'm just going to be a free agent.
Very good. And today, the focus is the book, Paul and Imperial Divine Honors. And you're a bit of an iconoclast here with this one. You're setting out to correct some problems in Pauline scholarship within your own denomination, even. One of the biggest names to ever have written on the subject, N.T. Wright, who you interact with a little bit. Specifically, you're dealing with this broadly accepted idea. I think I must have come across it in the early 2000s, but this idea that Paul's letters are intentionally interacting with and subverting the imperial cult, which is defined as the worship of Roman emperors, whether living or dead. What's wrong with the idea of the imperial cult? Let's just start there.
Yeah, so there was no such thing as the imperial cult. So I direct you not only to this book, but Simon Price, his book, which is called The Imperial Cult in Roman Asia Minor. That's the subtitle. The first one is Rituals and Power, and then Roman Religions of Rome by North Bearden Price. Second volume, they're on like page 346. That's where the quote comes, I think. Or 328, I think it is. There is no such thing as the imperial cult. So it's a scholarly construct that classicists have been using since the late 19th century and a little bit before that. What they talk about and use it as, they use it in a much more nuanced way than New Testament scholars typically do or tend to. So there is no such thing as the imperial cult. What we have are actually grants of imperial divine honors that happen in four different levels in the Roman world. You have this city of Rome and also colonies of Rome, which are very different from the next three. All of these four are very different. They share some similarities, but mostly they share a lot of differences. This second type are what scholars term provincial divine honors or provincial imperial divine honors. These are imperial divine honors that provinces get together and bestow upon an emperor. Then you have civic or municipal imperial divine honors, which are divine honors that cities or municipalities in the Greco-Roman world, the governing bodies once again get together and bestow those. And then you have individual or private imperial divine honors, which are the divine honors that take place in the people's homes or the private spaces of associations. Each one has its own particular context, and each one is unique. So let's just say like one city, typically most often what they do, one city, province, person, or the city of Rome, typically one thing that all four share among them is benefaction in some way, shape, or form. And so the city of Rome, for example, will bestow divine honors only on a select few emperors. Yet only half of Julio-Claudians were deified. So Julius Caesar, Augustus, and Claudius. Tiberius wasn't, Caligula wasn't, and Nero wasn't. And so it's if they ruled the empire well and the divine honors are always posthumous, they usually consist of a temple, an altar, and a priest in the city of Rome. So we know about those. Also, those are very similar to what we have in colonies, and two of the cities I focus on in the book are colonies, so Corinth and Philippi. With provinces, typically their divine honors bestowed on living emperors. In the Julio-Claudian period, typically it was not just a single emperor. It was to an emperor and either the goddess Roma, or another time that we know about, it was to Tiberius, his mother Livia, and the Senate in Rome. And so you typically have several people. And they're ones that the province sponsors are typically bestowed on emperors or imperial family members while they're alive. Since Romans are involved in the direct running of those particular grants of imperial divine honors, they're more conservative. So, you know, I've just talked about how they weighted all divine honors at the city level, the official level in Rome, are posthumous. They don't call emperors who are alive gods. The official documents associated with emperors in Rome. We're not talking about what a sycophantic court poet may say. We're talking about the official documents, the inscriptions that we have. We have copious amounts of inscriptions from Rome. Those are not called a living emperor. If they're official, they don't call them a god. Same way in provincial imperial divine honors, typically people shy away from calling the living emperor a god. The third type with cities and municipalities are, once again, it's because most often because of benefaction, and these are just local city groups, the governmental bodies politic within those groups getting together and decreeing divine honors, most often for a living emperor or his family members, in response to a benefaction. And those are not controlled by Rome in any way, shape, or form. So all bets are off. They're calling emperors gods, calling them Olympians, and those types of things. Sometimes they let Rome know that they're doing this and the emperor know and the family members, and sometimes they don't. The emperors may write back and try to curb, you know, some of those things, but it really doesn't work because they give them the ability to live life like they always have. And this was a practice that began in the Hellenistic period, and so they kept on. And then typically when you have an emperor or his family member who dies, they either combine the cult into just a cult of Augustan gods, or they just do away silently, kind of with the cult. And then you have the private imperial divine honors, which are the least studied of all of them. And those are typically, once again, given to emperors or imperial family members while they are alive. Sometimes they last after their death, but they're typically, because given by an individual or an association, a group of people, because of some kind of benefaction that's been wrought for them. And they'll call the emperor god and Olympians, those types of things, and they'll incorporate them into their domestic hearths and those types of things. So they're very diverse, and there's just not one central controlled imperial cult where you have an emperor in Rome making all the decisions, saying who worships whom and all that.
So what sorts of actions do you have in mind that qualifies divine honors? You mentioned the construction of a temple, the consecration of a priest or priests. What else goes along with that in the practice of bestowing honor upon a deceased emperor?
So essentially what imperial divine honors consist of would be honors that are similar to those that Greeks and Romans gave to their gods, but they differ in degree. So you're talking about any cultic act made to or on behalf of an emperor, which would include priests or priestesses. Typically, not always, but typically male Julio-Claudians get priests and female Julio-Claudians get priestesses, but that's not always the case. There are exceptions. This would include processions, prayers, sacrifices. So the sacrifices could be something as big as an ox or a cow, something as small as just wine or some incense, hymns. It could be a dedicated imperial cultic altar. It could be a festival. It could be games. Typically every fifth year they would have those games. It could be a cultic image of some kind. It could also be divine title that someone just gets hailed on a coin. It could be a shrine, which is different than a temple. A shrine just may be like a sacred space. It could be a temple. The temple could be really small. The temple could be a massive temple complex like we know existed in the case for some temples in Roman Asia, those types of things. So they're basically all of those things are things in which Greeks and Romans gave to their gods.
Very good. And talk about benefaction a little bit. Why would a city, for example, want to spend all this money to honor a deceased emperor? Like, why would they do that? What are they getting out of it?
Yeah, so for some, it's not someone who's deceased, someone who's still alive. So typically with Rome, that's where the focus is on the deceased Julio-Claudians. And those are basically, I would say, I don't know this for a fact, and that's not particularly stated in this way, but you do have references in Greek and Roman historians, ancient Roman historians, that is, who talk about how this is a practice in Rome where if you rule the empire well, you will be deified after you die. And so it kind of is an incentive, I think, just as much. There's where the part is where I think I read into maybe the wrong word, but you know, it seems to be a thing to encourage people to be a good Roman emperor and not a despot and not a tyrant. But definitely when you have provinces and cities and individuals who grant divine honors to a Roman emperor, Most often it is because of a benefaction that someone, an imperial family member or an emperor has brought to them, has wrought for them. And that's exactly the reason why people worship the gods. So first and foremost, it's not really, you know, it's not a huge step to go from worshiping a god to worshiping a human who has what seems to be the power of the gods, controls life and death, and does a few other things like that. But because the system is predicated on a system of gift exchange. So unlike modern forms of Christianity and Judaism, where, you know, we as Christians, we worship God because we believe he's the creator, and then honor and glory are due to him, and those types of things. So for Greeks and Romans, their gods didn't create the world. A different generation of gods did that. Their gods brought order out of chaos, and those gods provide, you know, a healthy growing season, healthy children. They provide tangible benefactions, and in return for that, you offer sacrifice, which shows your expression of gratitude for that, but also stores up kind of a future account that you can kind of debit from if you need something. And so you have the same thing with Roman emperors. You give to them, you let them know if you can. Some people do and some people don't. We know that a lot of embassies were crisscrossing all over the Mediterranean to find the Roman emperor and his family members, wherever they were, to let them know that, hey, we have offered divine honors to you, and here's why. And sometimes emperors will respond and say, hey, you're going overboard. You should not do that. But I mean, obviously, I think they use that political and religious capital for their benefit. So it's kind of one of these things where you're showing gratitude, because people oftentimes, I think, don't think about the reality of what it would have been like to live in the first century BC in particular, and have gone through the civil wars that, and they came into Greece, they came into Egypt, they came into Asia Minor, and to have, you know, soldiers running amok, to have inflation, to have divine images being looted and taken other places, and then obviously have a guy who comes in and puts a stop to all that, returns the divine images where they need to be, allows economic prosperity. People began to go on massive building campaigns to build these beautiful cities that we can see when we go over there, the remains of them. And so for people who lived at that day and age, I mean, it was a wonderful thing for them. And I think they really appreciated that, because they didn't have to build troops. They didn't have to, you know, pay exorbitant prices for grain. And they could live, they had a better quality of life because of Augustus physically. You can talk about what other things you want to, but, you know, on the money level to support their families, they had a better quality of life during his reign and post. And so people were very appreciative of that. And they passed decrees to talk about that. And so there are more grants of divine honors for Augustus than anybody else. And it's because his take place after 50 years plus of civil war that spilled all over the Mediterranean. And so people are really appreciative of that. But at the same time, just like their gods are sort of storing up, you know, clout or storing up some credit that they can draw from in case they need, because Augustus and the Roman emperors prided themselves on being good lawgivers and good judges. And we have a case, for example, it's an inscription that's in my book on inscriptions, where this family on this island, they're a prominent Greek family. Their people were trying to break into their house for 3 nights. They were defending their property, and they commanded a slave to go up and drop some excrement from a, what would you call that? What's the?
A chamber pot?
A chamber pot, basically, yeah. To spill it on top of the people who were trying to break into their house. He actually drops the chamber pot and kills one of the guys. Well, that particular city convicted the man and the woman whose house was being broken into. Well, she appeals to Augustus, and he appeals to Augustus and says, hey, can you please help us? And Augustus sets it all right, and even says you need to change the archives that you have in your city to make your decree read the right way. And so you had, you know, sort of a Supreme Court that you could go to. And so I think people really appreciated that, and they would, you know, but that also, if they had given divine honors to Augustus, it gave them just a little bit of clout or credit from which they could draw, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. So this whole idea is that, one, they're kind of just like thank yous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for your support, or thanks for investing in the city in some way, for the economy and everything else. So that's interesting. Let's talk about some technical terms. I think you'll enjoy this. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 different ones to talk about, and okay. You just let it rip with each one. Okay. Say whatever you want to say.
Okay.
But these are quote-unquote technical terms that Pauline scholars point to in his epistles to make the case that Paul is very intentionally setting up Christ over against Caesar, you know, those who receive imperial divine honors. And so the first pair, I'll give it to you as a pair, is Lord and Savior, Kyrios and Soter. So you have to pardon my Greek. I say it like the Greeks, not like the Erasmian. But so what do you think about Lord and Savior? Everybody knows that that's a strong imperial term, right?
Yeah, correct. Well, that's what they say. That is what they claim. When you look at actually, so soter, absolutely. That is a word since the 3rd century BC and beforehand during the Hellenistic empires. Gets used for Hellenistic kings, for generals. That term has cultic connotations to it. So I don't really doubt that part of it. As a matter of fact, Christian Habich, I mean, is a phenomenal book, Divine Honors for Mortal Men. I forgot the German title, but it was his dissertation, which 50 years later gets translated into English and gets updated. Because soter is used so often in this context of divine honors, even if you don't have evidence, direct evidence of it, if you see soter, you typically can say that there was probably divine honors being given to a particular person. So I don't doubt that one. But Lord, the earliest datum that we have for Kyrios outside of the southern Levant, so ancient Syria, the Holy Land, Egypt, dates to AD 67. So a few years after St. Paul is probably martyred in Rome. Doesn't appear, I mean, the thousands of inscriptions that we have from all over the place, Asia Minor, mainland Greece, you don't see Kyrios being used as an imperial title. So my argument that I had in my first book on inscriptions, and it's not just mine, there are a few other people who have noticed this and gone back, it's really an ancient Near Eastern custom. It's one of these, we often think that the influence goes Rome and East, where this is a case where influence goes East to West, that it's an ancient Near Eastern custom to refer to a monarch as a lord. So go to the Code of Hammurabi, for example. You know, it's way back. I'm not a specialist in that, so I'm not going to talk about that. But if you just go and get the context of scripture out and you look at the inscriptions, it's really customary to call a king a lord. The earliest attestations that we have of emperors being called lords, kurioi, come from the southern Levant. I don't think in this particular case that it is a title with connotations of divinity. I think it's more of a title, it's a kingly title. And then you don't really see it picking up until the end of Nero's reign, where AD 67 in Boeotia, he gets called in Acmonia, he gets called Kyrios of the entire world. And that's kind of one of the first ones. And then it becomes part of the imperial titular later, but really post first century. So what I did is from those particular cases, I went back and I looked at soter and Kyrios and their Latin synonyms in the cities of Philippi, Corinth, and Thessalonica. The earliest person to be called Lord in an inscription from Philippi is Constantine. And so, I mean, it's at
3 centuries later.
Correct. Yeah. You don't have anybody called soter in Philippian inscriptions, and you wouldn't really expect it to be at the public level because the inscriptions, mainly for the first 3 centuries of the after the birth of Jesus, are in Latin. And then in Corinth, you don't really see those in any inscriptions. You don't see Kyrios, and you don't see soter. And to my knowledge, it's been a while since I wrote that book, and I'm working on another book right now. And I have a lot of other stuff in my mind about financial advising and other stuff that I do. But there's one inscription, I think, from Thessalonica that calls the Emperor Augustus soter. But that's it. And so he's a soter in Thessalonica, but he's not a soter in Corinth, and he's not a soter in Philippi. Because by the time Paul gets there, he's gone from being a human to being someone whom the Senate in Rome has recognized as a divine being. And so, you know, he's sort of graduated. So by the time St. Paul is writing epistles, Augustus is what's called a divus, which was the official title that the Senate in Rome gave to an emperor whom they deified.
Very good. So this exposes to a certain degree your method, which is to, instead of universalizing and generalizing ways of thinking about the emperors, you get specific and you focus on one region and you interpret each within the light of its own local context, rather than thinking there was some sort of macro standardized language. I think there are some things that are like that, of course. Like the word Caesar, know, is used a lot, and other plenty of other concepts and words. But your method is really to say, okay, look, we're studying the Epistle to the Philippians. It doesn't seem valid to me to use something said of Nero in the year 67 when Philippians was written before that ever occurred, and then to read that back into, for example, in the Carmen Christi in Philippians 2:11, you know, that he's the Lord overall, you know, and say, okay, this is over against Caesar. You're blowing the whistle, you're saying foul, can't do that, bad exegesis, bad cultural background.
Yeah, because those two particular places, so the place that where Nero's called was Acmonia in Boeotia, the context there is he actually let mainland Greece be tax-free. No one ever done that. And he even boasts about that in the speech that he gave, which he gave in Corinth, where he freed the Greeks and said, you don't have to pay taxes anymore. So that's that specific context. That's where the kurios of the entire world comes from. Ha kurios tu kosmou, I think it is. You can't read that context into Philippi, which if you understand Philippi, people say, what's a colony of Rome? They don't understand what that means. It means that Greek Philippi was wiped off the face of the map. The people who owned property in that city, who were Greeks, were disenfranchised. We don't know what happened to them. Soldiers were settled there. Latin was the official language. Roman was the official culture. And in the same small group of people, we know this from inscriptions, had socially conservative people who tried to maintain their identity, were in charge for 300 years. They didn't let outsiders in. That's two totally different situations. And my point is, even if you did want to read kurios into Philippians 2:11, it can't be talking about an emperor, because the Greek term that is used to translate divus, which is the Latin term used to talk about a deified Roman imperial family member or emperor, is not kurios. Everyone knows who looks at inscriptions and you see the bilingual translation, it's theos. It's that term. I mean, I point you, if you're here and you don't believe that, Simon Price has a really great article from 1984 called Gods and Emperors, where he talks about the language that Greeks used for Roman emperors and specifically how they translated divus into Greek, and it's always theos.
Right. And that's not so difficult for us to figure out, because we do have bilingual inscriptions. Of course, I remember my first encounter with one was the Library of Celsus in downtown Ephesus, the two sides along the stairs. And that was actually my assigned presentation for that trip. Then this past April, I was able to travel again, not in such a scholarly context, but just more as with a bunch of people, more touristy. But I was able to convince the tour guide to let me present on the Library of Celsus again.
I love it. That's
which,
great.
You know, I let her speak first, and then I said, I have some things to add. She said, oh, okay. So that was fun to do. But yeah, these bilingual inscriptions are are around. And, you know, I was looking, I was at Philippi recently too as part of that trip, because we did Turkey and Greece. And it was exhausting. But in Philippi, there were a lot of Latin inscriptions. You know, like, I think there's like some Byzantine stuff that's Greek, and you can always kind of tell with the font, if I can put it that way, that they use, the Byzantines use. But like, there were actually a lot of Latin inscriptions. And, you know, that's weird. It's weird when you're in the country of Greece and you're looking at a Greek city, you know, which was Greek, and then there's this Roman colony period, and then it kind of like gets Hellenized again later, Byzantinized maybe, you know, that there is this Latin influence. So, you know, it is very important to consider that and also what you read about Corinth. But, you know, I don't want to get too into the weeds in this. Yeah. I want to throw at you the word gospel, because I imagine you probably went to Preen and as part and I know I went. It wasn't too impressive. Yeah. Anyhow, talk about the word gospel, because some scholars have said that by saying gospel, what Paul's doing is coming over against the Roman imperial gospel of peace and, you know, security that the emperors have brought.
Kind of once again, it's one of the, in this particular case, I would say this is not a technical term, because if it was a technical term, we would find it used in official Roman documents or official documents by Greek cities. And if you comb through inscriptions that have been published, for example, I think there's like 240,000 and counting on epigraphy.pacum. It appears in three inscriptions. Three out of 240,000 plus. And that's not every inscription. And I'm not saying it doesn't appear in more, because, you know, there's a lot of inscriptions that are not published yet, or they're not on the PACUM database. But still, three inscriptions that have to do with Julio-Claudians or Roman emperors in some capacity. And to me, I mean, one in particular case, I think I talk about all three of those inscriptions in, I think, the chapter on Thessalonica. One of those is an actual good news gods, gods and goddesses. And so, but it's related to an imperial victory. The other is the birth of the Emperor Augustus from the inscription from Priene. Yeah. But three is not enough. And it's, if you look how the words used elsewhere, it's just a common term for good news. And so it's even used within Thessalonica, but it's used in Thessalonica for good news that has been received of those good news gods that are, they've sacrificed to the good news gods after the city of Thessalonica has heard positive news about their city from, I think it's the Emperor Hadrian, but it's in the second century. And so it's just not, it's not a word you find used all the time, and the, and it's used in one place. Now, I was preparing for a class that I'm doing. That's just free for anybody who wants to take it on imperial divine honors. And, you know, this is the only inscription that N.T. Wright cites. And he notes that it's the only inscription, but he says we need to give it more weight than we give other things, basically. And to me, I just don't think you can do that. And so if you look at how euangelion is used across the board, it's not a technical term. It's used in a variety of different contexts and a variety of different ways. And the other thing is, there is no Latin equivalent. The thing that struck me as I was doing research, and I did not know that at the time, I assumed there was a Latin equivalent. I think probably most, the reason that the word came over is just a transliteration probably by Christians, because in the first century BC, and if someone can correct me if I'm wrong, if that's not the case, but it seems to me probably the most likely explanation for the word in Latin, because when Cicero, who is, you know, famous orator, knows the Latin language, when he writes and wants to use good news, he uses the Greek euangelion. So he's writing in Latin or dictating. He didn't write. Well, he wrote some letters, very, very few. As he's dictating.
He had that famous secretary who could write down as fast as Cicero could talk. What was Tyro was his name? Or
I think it was Tyro, yes.
Tyro.
Tyro. So when he's speaking and dictating, he switches when he gets to good news and says euangelia, the plural. So that tells me that probably euangelium didn't exist in Latin in the first century BC.
Yeah.
And probably
not the first century. Yeah, if somebody was going to know it, it would be Cicero for sure.
So that's what seems to me,
Yeah. So with Lord, we're not looking at that as a technical term or gospel. Savior could?
Yeah, it could be. I should stay away from technical because it's most often used of gods. So there's a book that was published in the last couple of years about soteria, basically savior gods. I forgot the name of the individual, the scholar who published the book, but there is a chapter in there on, and talks about Christians as well, but most often it is used in the context of gods being savior gods, but it also can be used of humans, and it's typically because they've done something concrete that it has resulted in the well-being of a particular person. That's what they usually call it, because it's a very contextual term. So it is a term that I would say it is not technical, but it is a term that has cultic connotations, and if an emperor is called that, he's probably receiving some kind of divine honors.
Okay, let's talk about another pairing of words, parousia and apontesis. So the coming and meeting as used in 1 Thessalonians 4, the coming of Christ and then meeting him in the air. The argument is that these are terms that are specifically used for Roman emperors visiting.
Yep.
And so maybe you could help us with that a little.
Yeah. So when I hear technical term, I think of a term that is used only for one specific thing. That's how I interpret technical. This is a technical term that we use for this particular thing. But if you just read the Bible, that argument kind of falls apart. So parousia and apontes is used in the Old Greek, in the Septuagint and the Old Greek, for people just coming to meet or people coming and going. St. Paul will use parousia for him coming and going, for his apostolic colleagues coming and going. I don't see anyone, when it comes to those particular passages and commentaries that are reading that are anti-imperial, picking up on those types of things. It's usually typically on this 1 Thessalonians 4. And if you just look at how it's used in broader Greco-Roman literature and culture, once again, we have a word that is used for various things in various contexts. But to me, you can use the term, and it's how you use the term and what context that you use the term that determines whether or not you're referring to an emperor or not. But for most of the cities that St. Paul wrote to, an emperor never went to those cities in the first century AD, especially during the Julio-Claudian period. So I kind of understand, I'm more sympathetic to that, but it's definitely not a technical term. So I want to push back against that and just say, you know, context determines what it means. It does mean the coming, and this is the coming of Jesus. It's not necessarily, it's also used the coming of gods, you know, the parousia of a deity. It's not a term that specifically says, oh, this is anti-imperial, because this is a term that's only used of the emperor.
Scholars maybe don't do it quite as much, but certainly my brothers, the pastors, you know, you find this among preachers a lot where we just run with this stuff. It's like candy to a preacher to be able to say, oh, you know, this is, you know, you're reading the text and you're like, this word is a word that was used also to refer to meeting the emperor when he came to visit. So therefore, you know, it's just seems like something you're trying to correct and say, look, this is parallels, maybe, or it's just a word that means this thing. It's not, it's not a specialized usage.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think you're right. I mean, I have pastors that will ask me questions, some of whom are clients, some who are friends, you know, ask me questions. And it's typically, you know, they're in the midst of sermon prep and they got a really good point that they want to make. And if they could just make it in this particular way, that it'll be, I've even asked that, well, can I make that point in this way? I'm like, I wouldn't.
But yeah, exactly.
Do whatever you want to do.
Yeah. As those who are speaking in churches, I think it is important to get this right, you know, because whether it sounds good or whether it lands well rhetorically should not be the decisive factor in whether or not we use something. Its veracity, obviously, would be more important. Yeah. You could tell a great lie and everyone's very impressed, but it's still a lie.
Maybe I'm
being too harsh here, because I don't think most people are like, oh, I know this is an exaggeration, because it's in the commentaries, so therefore it must be true.
Right. Yeah. And I don't fault them, you know, and I don't really necessarily fault New Testament scholars, because they don't have the tools. They haven't been trained. I feel like I've been blessed. God has provided me with the tools necessary that most New Testament scholars don't get trained with. Instead of spending my time learning about justification by faith, in reading 1,000 books on the subject, I was reading inscriptions and I was touring around. I was excavating for 4 years, seeing how archaeologists gather their material. I was just exposed to a whole world that textual scholars who focus on text were not. And so, you know, they just don't have the tools to adjudicate claims, and they just pass them on because it is the standard scholarly accepted position. And I'm just trying to bring some clarity to it to say, hey, listen, I wish it were the case, but it's really, I used to think it was, but it wasn't until I actually got in the sources to see, went back to the sources.
Yep. Ad fontes.
Amen. Like a good Protestant.
Desiderius Erasmus, baby.
Yeah.
So let's talk about a couple of quick ones in Corinthians, and then I think we do have to wrap it up. But in 1 Corinthians 2, 6 through 8, we have this statement, yet among the mature we do speak wisdom, though it is not a wisdom of this age or the rulers of this age who are being destroyed, but we speak God's wisdom, a hidden wisdom which God decreed before the ages for our glory, and which none of the rulers of this age understood, for if they had, they would have not crucified the Lord of glory. So you You don't see the rulers of this age in this passage as referring to the Roman emperor or his governor who executed Jesus, right? So how do you interpret this section? Because I think this is another one of these where people are thinking, you know, Paul's coming against the Roman imperial mindset here.
Yeah, I do not think it is. Well, first and foremost, ask the question of if they knew who Jesus was, why it doesn't make sense to me that they wouldn't crucify him. Because they're not Christians. They're not Jews. I mean, like, it doesn't make any sense to me to say that if these people actually knew the identity of Jesus and who Jesus was, I think they still would have crucified him. They would not have cared not to have crucified him. Just logically, that doesn't make sense to me. And maybe that's a limitation on my part. So my reading of that passage is we're talking about the spiritual beings. And I think people don't like to talk about them as much is because we live in a post-Christian world. And most people think that spiritual beings do not exist, you know? And so the swing from interpreting as spiritual beings to more imperial rulers is the fact that people just don't want to have to deal with discussing about spiritual beings. Do they exist? If they do exist, then, you know, how do they affect us now? Did Paul think they existed? So it's kind of a way for us to present a more sort of rational post-Christian, post-Enlightenment version of the gospel, more of a demythologization. Thank you. It seems to me to be on that path, but I know great people who hold that position and who don't believe that, but it seems to me that that is one of the things that it does. So I think it's the spiritual beings.
Okay. There are spiritual powers behind the earthly, or arjontes, behind the earthly rulers.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Again, it's sort of, you know, from Daniel with the Prince of Persia withstanding.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all of that. So, you know, that's what, I mean, I think that is Paul's frame of reference. That's what he thinks. It's not a Western modern thought. People kind of are, you know, shy away from it. But that, yeah, I don't know what that means nowadays. I've always thought about that.
Well, it sure seems that there's something going on, you know, where there are these, we're old enough to have seen significant cultural shifts occurring on their surface don't really make sense.
Yeah.
Right. And you can say, well, you know, what's the cause? Is it just chaos? Is it just randomness? Is it just a popular, like what makes an idea go viral and another idea doesn't go viral? You know, these are all legitimate questions, I think.
Yeah, I don't doubt that spiritual forces exist. I just don't know how to make the jump from the spiritual forces being over individual nations, which is what you have in Daniel and what you have in the Old Testament, to what it means now, because we just created a bunch of nations after World War I and World War II, we carved up the maps. Yeah. So, like, I really don't know what to do with that. But I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, you see stuff that is happening in our world. Sometimes, you know, you can feel the presence of evil in places. And if I feel the presence of evil, you know, I'll just leave and try to get as far away from that as possible.
Well, let's talk about 1 Corinthians 8, 5 and 6, which says, indeed, even though there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as in fact there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father. And then he talks about one Lord, Jesus Christ. Now, I personally strongly disagree with the recent trend to say that Paul is doing something with the Shema here. I just don't see enough dependence to make that case. But I don't want to get distracted by that anyhow.
Yeah.
I want to get into asking you, when he says there are many gods and many lords, is that referring to Roman emperors or how do you see that?
It could, but it doesn't single them out. So the argument I push back against is one from Winter and Wright. Wright will say something to the effect of the gods on earth can only be Roman emperors. And I don't understand why anyone would say that. It seems to me that if you look at the inscription, so that's kind of how this started. I was taking a course on, well, not how it started, but that's one of the six significant parts of this book was a term paper that I wrote for Laura Nostralla in her class on 1 Corinthians that I then published. Because I kept coming across this idea that these, you know, lords and gods, that the lords in particular are Roman emperors within Corinth. So I said, well, what did the Corinthians call them? And it's really easy to see. We have a lot of inscriptions from Corinth. They've been published, has been excavated, you know, since the early 20th century. And I went back through the inscriptions and there's not a single Julio-Claudian that is called a Kurios. They're called Diwi, which is a plural of Diwis. And then there are a few Greek inscriptions associated with the games that Corinth oversaw, the Pan Isthmian Games. It came to me. That gets calced on, the Imperial Divine Honors gets calced onto that. And then those inscriptions are typically in Greek. And in those cases, what they'll do is they'll call a Roman emperor or empress in one case, which is Livia, Theos or Thea, but they don't call them Kurios, because Kurios is not the Greek translation of Delos. It's Theos once again. It seems to me people in Corinth would have missed the boat if Paul intended them to see, because the inscriptions that people put up, that people read, don't have Kurios in them for a Roman emperor or someone within the imperial family.
So what do you think it refers to, gods and lords?
I just think it refers to various deities. Serapis is a tradition of Serapis being called Lord. You know, those great papyrus documents that are invitations to, you know, the Lord Serapis invites you to come to dinner at his temple. Those types of things that have been found at Oxyrhynchus.
So the lords and gods probably refers to deities and not Roman emperors. That's the point. So yeah. One more question about Corinth. You know, obviously you wrote a lot about Philippi, Thessalonica, and Corinth. Your Corinth chapter, probably twice as long as the others. And you kind of get into a really interesting question that I haven't seen others raise. I just haven't thought about it either. But it's the question of, why didn't the Christians in Corinth really suffer persecution much? Or why, you know, you talk about all the different ways in which Christians were interacting with pagans that are mentioned in just 1 Corinthians alone.
Yeah.
And it's quite extensive. Well, on my way to asking you about that, you know the Erastus inscription?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you think that's the Erastus mentioned in other places in the New Testament, or you think it's a different guy?
Okay, I started a podcast a couple years back, and then I got a job as financial advisor and had to abandon the podcast. But I did a podcast on it. It's called Biblipigraphy. I think it's the Erastus inscription. I also did the Nazareth inscription, and then I did an update on the Nazareth inscription because the suggestion that I made was proven right. So I wanted to just make sure that people knew that. But I don't think the Erastus inscription, I don't think it's a clear-cut case where it refers to the Erastus from Romans chapter 16 and verse 23. And also this mentioned, I think, in 2 Timothy.
2 Timothy 4:20.
Yeah. And the reason is, see, it hasn't been published. Okay. And that's the hard part is, but the excavator, I did a lot of back and forth to excavators from Corinth too, and other people who knew the excavators from Corinth. Steve Friesen was so generous with his time. He actually has a better relationship with, the last name is Williams. I forgot his first name. The guy who's publishing, it's still going to be published. It really hasn't been published in the sense of the archaeological context for it hasn't been published. But basically, the archaeological context seals the deal for me in that it dates after the first century, as I recall, where it's post-Pauline, basically. And to the extent where, if this Erastus mentioned in Romans and 2 Timothy is Erastus, you'd have to have been like a small child. And I don't think that was the case. So it was the archaeological evidence that sealed the deal for me. However, the epigraphic evidence on the face of it does argue for a mid-first century date, because you got the same type of inscription that's in Philippi, same type of inscription that's at Pisidian Antioch, because it's basically bronze letters that were put into the floor.
Yeah, you can tell that the letter spaces are really wide.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes it a little harder to read. So bronze would bring a lot more clarity to it.
Yeah, and so that part of it argues for an early date, because most of those inscriptions are like mid-first century A.D., The thing, though, that seals the deal for me is, but unless that document gets published or the book ever gets published with the archaeological context of the inscription itself, and we can, you know, we see that there's flawed, then that would change my mind. But as of right now, the archaeology, I've been told by people who know it and are that it dates it into the second century.
Okay, so if that's the case, then let's just put Erastus to the side. Okay. But let's just say there's another individual mm-hmm. who is a high status citizen, maybe of decurial rank, or maybe, what's the other one, Augustale?
You got, it could be a decurion, it could be an idol, it could be a duawir, or duumwir.
No, I'm thinking of like a freedman who rose very high.
It could be a quaestor.
Okay, yeah. So, whatever. I mean, somebody from that upper level... that is him or herself a Christian
yes.
and is in some way protecting offering some sort of measure of benefaction, I guess, to the early Christian movement in Corinth, such that they just didn't need to worry about it because somebody big had their back. Is that a possibility, you think? It's just the only thing that kind of came to my mind as I was thinking about it, over against just like thinking of the over-realized eschatology position that you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely possible. I personally think circumstantial, anecdotal evidence within Acts, because I do think that's kind of a reason why non-Christ confessing Jews go after Paul, is he seems to be taking more upper members of society who can benefit and have the back of the Jewish communities in these cities. So I don't think it's unheard of. And I don't think it would be out of the realm of possibility, but there's no hard evidence from Corinth to suggest it that I know of, other than the Erastus inscription, if it is in fact dated to the mid-first century.
Right. So let's kind of summarize a little bit.
Yeah.
You established without question that in Philippi, in Thessalonica, in Corinth, these cities were bananas for bestowing divine honors on Roman emperors. And their, you know, their family, Julio-Claudian Roman families, no question there.
Correct.
How could you summarize, I guess, how Christianity interfaced with that in light, you know, obviously you've got multiple hundreds of pages doing this, but like in a short summary, like what could pastors reasonably use in sermons to say, in light of the fact that Roman imperial divine honors did happen in the context in which early Christianity was coming on the scene?
Yeah. So I think pastors, it would be helpful for pastors to know that most often imperial divine honors were calced onto and offered alongside of honors to traditional gods. We come from a very Christian perspective where we think, you know, you got to choose just one way, you know, it's either God's way or not, you know. But if you live in a world where you're not a monotheist and you think that all gods equally exist, then you don't really care. So there's just a lot of, lack of a better term, tolerance. And so I think pastors need to realize that the evidence that we have, and I try to show in the book, is that imperial divine honors are not separate alone, separated by themselves, that they're intertwined with the larger society. And so we cannot isolate them as the sole reason if Christians experience persecution or hostility within a city. It's because they're so intertwined within the culture. And so what you really have is you have Christianity trying to overturn large aspects of the culture. And that's typically where the rub comes when you have Christians trying to overturn centuries of tradition and trying to do away with the gods that people really think bring protection and bring the growing seasons and those types of things. And so trying to introduce piety back into the conversation, the whole anti-imperial thing to me is focused more on politics and power. And I don't think everything boils down to politics and power. I'm just sorry. Some people I know, I've gotten to know pastors as a financial advisor who make decisions based on piety, and they are suffering because of it. They're not eating. There's a guy right now that I know that he goes and sells plasma to pay the bills because he's so committed to this church. And so to me, you got to bring piety back into the conversation. So I don't doubt that people reacted with hostility against Christians because of the fact that they're overturning their gods that their family members have worshiped and have been acclaimed in their city for centuries. And so I would just hope that people could see that basically society is just a mesh and you can't really isolate imperial divine honors from them. So anything that is really not anti-imperial, you're anti-Greco-Roman culture. And I say Greco first because it is a Greek culture that has a Roman veneer attached to it. And we forget that. It's not, there's a lot of aspects of Greek culture that Paul's opposing that are not necessarily Roman.
Right. Although that veneer might be a little thicker in Philippi
and
Corinth. But well, let me just summarize what I think you just said first, and then I'll ask another question. So what I think you just said is that the question of imperial divine honors is really a subset of the question of how Christianity interacted with the Greco-Roman belief in the gods in general. So it's just like kind of a subset within that same umbrella rather than something to be considered like on its own as like the secret key to unlock the true meaning of the epistle, the church epistles or something.
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly. That's a great way to think about it.
Okay. You know, you're probably not going to like this question, but I'm going to ask it anyhow.
Okay.
And feel free to just ignore it. But how does this inform you of how to think about America today?
Yeah.
And the modern context, and like you said, everyone's obsessed with power. It's the postmodern interpretive lens for everything.
Yeah.
And I agree, it's annoying, but it is what it is. And so how does your work bear on how to be a Christian in America today?
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought in the conclusion to try to address this issue, but I tried and tried.
I didn't see it there. If you put it in, it was real subtle.
Well, it was taken out. It was definitely taken out. So it's a great question. I don't mind to answer it because I think it's the job of a historian, especially a historian who is pastor priest, to be able to speak into these things. And so I'm not going to shirk it. I think it kind of helps us with several things. Number one, just broadly speaking, the project in the book is trying to deconstruct something that shouldn't have been there in the first place. And so thinking about the fact that we all, regardless of the political party that we're in, don't need to take what someone says at face value. We should always do the digging and go back to the sources like I did in the book. And what I did in the book especially is, in case you have a question, I put the sources in the back. So you have every source that I ever consulted, sources that I looked at, and you got pictures, and you have all throughout the book. So I wanted someone to be able to basically recreate a thesis similar to my own. So I would encourage people to, I think it encourages us to do that. Just first and foremost, you've got fake news, or you've got, AI generated stuff, which is, in my opinion, I stay far away from AI. People call me all the time and ask me if I want to help grow my financial practice with AI. I'm like, no, man. Stay away. We need more humanity in the world, not less. And so the number one is we all need to do, especially in this election cycle, the hard work of going and figuring out what exactly the person that we are thinking about voting for said, not to see snippets taken out of context here. Because I think what this book shows is people can take that one inscription from Praene that says gospel and use that out of context to argue something that, in my opinion, is not true. And so we all just need to do the hard work of actually going back to the sources. I would say that was the first thing. I think if we can go back to the sources and actually see what people are saying, as opposed to the medium through which we receive it and hearing what they say that people are saying, I think we would have a much more civil election cycle, first and foremost. So that's the main thing that I think that just the project in and of itself. Now, the content of the book helps me to see, and I hope that maybe people get encouraged by it, is that it seems that St. Paul wasn't really concerned about politics. It doesn't matter who's in charge. I think he thinks everything that is not in the hands of Christ, to think about what Teresa Morgan's work on In Christo means, but thinking that they're not under the authority or in the hands of Christ immediately, not what I like to call within the vanguard of new creation, things that are not there, are in the sphere of the evil one, and they're in the sphere of Satan and those spiritual powers that are in charge. And so I think people need to always remember that, and that, the systems in this world are corrupt, the systems in this world are evil. Satan is the god of this world, according to St. Paul in 2 Corinthians, right? I think people need to always remember that. I'll see a tweet, an awful tweet, about saying, hey, Christians, you need to remember that you worship an arrested, crucified criminal and support of Donald Trump. What are you doing? I have seen that tweet.
Wow.
What? People need to know that it doesn't matter who's in the White House. They don't have your best interest at heart. So I think people need to, regardless of what happens in 2024, St. Paul wouldn't really care. I think that's kind of what I have come to terms with, because he couldn't control who's on the throne in Rome. So I don't think he really cares. And I think people just get too upset about it, because really, it doesn't really matter.
Very good. Well, I just so appreciate your time today. How can people follow your work? You got a website or social media, or what would you refer people to?
Yeah, you can find me on X at dclintburnett1, I think. And then clintburnett.com is my website. I try to blog about once a month. I don't have a ton of time. And then I'm also on Facebook, but people can also email me or send me messages. I've got people that I respond to. I think if someone takes the time to read my work, purchase my work, or even just read my work and they send me an email, I'm happy to respond and to let them know. So you can send me an email specifically about this book to davidclintburnett@gmail.com, and I'm happy to answer your email. But I appreciate the time. Thank you so much, Sean. It was a pleasure. It was fun. Let's just hope that I didn't offend a lot of people.
No, it's a rousing conversation. And I appreciate not only your time, but also your transparency. You know, it takes courage, and I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you. Thank you much.
Well, that brings to an end this interview with a very fascinating scholar. I hope you enjoyed it and learned from it. You can get his book wherever you get your books. It's called Paul and Imperial Divine Honors. It's a fairly easy read for a scholarly book. He doesn't use a ton of technical jargon or anything like that. But what he does is explain very carefully what remains of Philippi, Corinth, and Thessalonica exist, and how those remains relate to the question of what people thought about the emperor and what kind of honors they gave to the emperor, especially divine honors, honors that are also given to gods. And so take a look at that. I think this is really a corrective to so much New Testament scholarship and pastoral preaching, myself included, because I have certainly used that Priena inscription. I think that's how he said it. I said preen, which just obviously was wrong. But hey, nobody's right all the time, are they? Anyhow, that inscription about the gospel that N.T. Wright makes a big deal about, I just finished reading a book by a prominent New Testament scholar, a popular level book. I won't name the person or the title of the book, but he has a whole chapter in it where he basically makes all of the moves that Burnett just disproved. Furthermore, I just did an interview with a gentleman, which you won't hear for a couple of weeks, where he does the same exact thing. He's like, well, when they said Jesus is Lord, what they were really saying is that Caesar is not Lord. So I didn't really feel like it was appropriate to correct this Old Testament PhD on that. You'll have to listen to future episodes to hear when that happens. But this is a commonplace idea, and it is something that shows up certainly in second century and beyond. And so we just assume that it's there in the time of the apostles and the early missions and the beginning of the church in the New Testament period. But as Burnett has pointed out, this is not what Lord was used for. There's only one inscription. It's from the year 67, which was after Paul was already dead and Peter was already dead, that we get the first usage of somebody using the word Lord to describe a Caesar. So really some fascinating stuff here, really some interesting correctives that we do well to consider as we continue to restore authentic Christianity, and we want to present it accurately as we continue to study and learn and as archaeology improves. I mean, it's incredible. I was just over there in Turkey and Greece, and they're finding new stuff. And there are plenty of cities that are still unexcavated where treasures lie, and future generations will be able to benefit from them. So as we always say here, the truth has nothing to fear. If you end up getting corrected by the facts of the matter and you believed in what turned out to be an overemphasis on politics and in Paul's epistles, hey, this is a great opportunity to reconsider and reapproach this in light of the evidence. Well, that's going to draw to an end our conversation today. I'm actually out of town this week, and so I'm not going to be inserting any comments from the website or from other sources today. But if you do want to join in on that, you can make comments on restitutio.org. You can make comments on the YouTube channel. You can make comments on Facebook. You can make comments on the Spotify feed. You can write a review in Apple Podcasts. Whatever you want to do to get in touch, would love to hear your thoughts about this interview. Well, thanks for listening to the end. If you'd like to support this ministry, you can do that at restitutio.org. I'll catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.